This is John Shannon with Radio Free Galisteo. Today we bring you part two of our interview with artist and Galisteo resident Woody Gwynn. Let's get right back into it. In the second half of our talk with painter Woody Gwynn, I left the questions mostly to Santa Fe-based landscape artist Matthew Higginbotham and regional artist and Woody's neighbor Denise Lynch. They delved into his influences and how and why he does what he does.
One of the questions I have, your sea scenes, were they inspired by your living back in Chatsford?
Oh, well, actually, I try to get out to the West Coast at least once a year, and I have for the last, I don't know, at least 15 or 20 years. I love Big Sur, and then all my wife and I have been going up to Oregon, which is also very beautiful, and she has a talent for finding really interesting places, and she found this house that's on the ocean. Well, it's actually on an estuary, and just changes constantly, these two rivers going into the Pacific and the tide coming and going and eagles and egrets and deer, and it's quite a thing, actually. You saw the sketches up there, yeah. Uh-huh. That's where I get my the ocean things. I'm not that familiar. I haven't experienced the East Coast as much as the West Coast. I love California, actually, but there's just, the only trouble is there's just so many people, you know. And then, of course, goes the other extreme. In Big Sur, there's no electricity for 45 miles. But that makes it part of it's what makes it so great, primal.
So in your realism, do you ever go to an emotional place in your work? Do you ever reach for that place? Or do you just let the image speak for itself?
Do I ever go to the emotional place?
Well, do you ever leave the emotional place?
Yeah. Well, I guess with realism, you know, the dream in some ways is to, in some way, like obliterate yourself so that you are not there, and it's somehow the actual experience, at least for a moment. But I have to have a feeling that I guess for more, you know, that you would call more or less emotional, I guess, in order to do anything, really. Otherwise, I don't know, I just as well have a glass of whiskey. Yeah. Well, really, I mean, I would say yes. If I don't have an emotional feeling about it, then why do it, I would say. But I try to have as much of it as I can. Like people say, do you work every day? Well, not every day, but I do have this morbid fear that if I really quit for too long a time, I might not ever start again. There's that fear. So I try to keep it up, keep going. I can't think of anything happier to do with my life than to do my work. That was one thing Peter Hurd said to me that first time. He said, you'll find out that when you're an artist that doing the work is where you get most of your fun. Yeah, I think he's right.
And that was right at the beginning of your career when you heard that.
Oh, yes, it sure was. And also, I saw a way of life that it's good to have mentors. Hey, I'm talking about, you know, an 18-year-old person. I remember it was snowy the day that I was there. I remember we walked out to his orangery, and he was walking in the snow, and I put my foot in his footprints in the snow and thought, I want to be an artist. That's what I want to do.
Denise?
I don't really have anything to say except you've been a great neighbor, and I love the way you paint sound, where it's like Comanche Gap and the sky is so quiet, but it does have a sound, and your paintings, I think, have really, really captured that. The epitome of the basin and the mysticalness of it, I think you've really captured it by being here.
Well, thank you. I think that in the world we live in, we need a little silence. At least I think I do. So you hope that the work can give people some feeling of comfort, compensation, or whatever. Again, back to the political thing, I mean, there are a lot of really hot issues right now, I know. But believe it or not, for better or for worse, 40 or 50 years from now, they probably won't matter. There'll be other hot issues. So I'm really not interested in... corny as this may sound, I'm not interested in what is current or au courant or timely. I'm only interested in what's timeless. And that may become partly because of my age, but I think I've always felt that way, really. timeless things tend to have a kind of silence about them. Wouldn't you agree?
There's a comfort in it.
I had a question about that beautiful orchard tree piece you did. It was quite big. It was like 80 inches, mm-hmm. 96 inches wide. And it was at Llewellyn probably 2 years ago. What was the inspiration for that piece? It was exquisite. That was absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. Well, actually, I've done 3 or 4 paintings of apple trees blossoming. That was, here again, bringing up Heard, that was at Easter time 4 or 5 years ago in the Hondo Valley or Hondo Valley. Nobody says that, but it was not too far from San Patricio. Unfortunately, that tree and a whole bunch of other beautiful old apple trees have since been cut down. Yeah, they weren't producing enough or whatever, so they just cut them down. But at least I got that painting. And I must say, I could probably make a living just doing that painting for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
You know, I really probably could. But
I love the one with the ladder, too.
Oh, yes.
The square piece.
Yeah. Let's see. Where was that? I think that was in Chimayo. And the last one I did, which was last year, was in Mora at the... that raspberry ranch, the...
Salmons?
Yeah, the salmon ranch. There's that house there that looks like it came from Gone with the Wind, built in the Civil War, and it has a really old apple orchard.
Probably one of the most emotive pieces that I've seen of you, and that's why I asked the question about the emotion, was the scene of the pinyon and the juniper on the hillside. It was an El Dorado maybe scene.
Oh, yeah,
with the mist.
That'll be in the opening tomorrow. I have a little study for that. I could bring it out.
That was emotional, very emotional.
Well, thank you.
You don't see that very often.
Well, thank you.
The misty scene.
Thank you.
You capture that just... beautifully, how it just goes into like the heavens and just disappears.
I know. Well, thank you very much. Sounds like it might have said to you what I was trying to get it to say. And thank you. I like that piece too, actually. It's a kind of a somber painting, but hey, you get to be my age, and I hope it has some joy in it too.
I love the resonance. Like, I never drive from Galisteo to Moriarty without that one scene of the tree in the vast landscape and the wind going through it.
Oh, uh-huh.
That is just such a resonating piece.
Yeah. That tree's all changed now, too.
It has.
Yeah, but that's okay.
When you started the day, is it all very, as an artist myself, and do you have a real schedule? Do you have a real routine?
You know, there's no point in working if you don't feel inspired. There's just really no... In fact, there's no point in doing anything unless you feel inspired. Like John, he should have felt... I'm sure, you know, he probably felt inspired to put that cap on, you know? And... you know what I'm saying? Yeah, and you should feel inspired about what you're going to have for lunch and everything. You know, if you don't feel that way, then don't bother you, I say. And the same thing with there's no point in working unless I feel inspired. And sometimes I feel a little like I need to just rest for a while. But for the most part, I could keep 3 or 4 of me busy. One thing I regret is that I'm really not a morning person. And I really admire people who are. I think it's great. You know, they get up in the morning and they're just ready to tear everything to pieces. But I'm not. I start working best in the afternoon. Aside from that, I mean, and sometimes I start out real early. So I don't have any schedule. In fact, I don't really. I mean, repetition drives me crazy, you know. So I try to keep mixed up a little bit, which makes me very hard to live around. My wife's long-suffering, but she's been great. She is great.
Talk about these books.
Yeah, I've been looking.
Oh, I know it is. I could open a bookstore at this point.
They're so fabulous.
Uh-huh. Here's a Agnes Martin book that I got and while she was still alive. And she signed it for me, but Oh, well, this is for my friend Woody, but on one of the other books that she signed for me, she left out the R, and it said, for my fiend, Woody.
Well, you think she left it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's right here somewhere. Yeah, she was a character.
She was telling the truth.
What's that? She was telling the truth. she thought it was very important to tell the truth. She felt like that, you know, when we do things that we shouldn't, that what we're doing is we're bending this diaphanous film that's in front of us of reality. And we're bending it and pushing it out of shape, but it bounces back into shape, and that's when we get hit. She had a very interesting way of seeing things. Now, she was, I mean, we have a lot of, eccentrics and have for many, many years in Santa Fe. But she truly had a unique way of seeing things, I must say.
You're listening to part two of Radio Free Galisteo's interview with artist and Galisteo resident, Woody Gwynn. You can support Radio Free Galisteo at www.patreon.com/Radio Free Galisteo.
One time I was over there, there was a sunset, and it was mackerel clouds, you know, those mackerel clouds. And the sun was underneath them and catching the light on the bottom of those mackerel clouds. And we stood there, looked at it for a while, and she said, well, they've really given us some glory tonight. And I said, Agnes, what do you mean by they? And she said, Woody, when it comes to transcendence, you are a real chicken. You know, she kept me laughing, really. She was funny. She had a great sense of humor. I think a lot of people have lost that. I asked her once, since I mentioned Wyeth, I said, what do you think of his work? And she said, well, I like it when he withholds enough, you know, which I thought was a very interesting way of, you know, of looking at him. And it's true about him. Well, the time I met O'Keefe over at the Sarkissian, that was back in the 70s, and she had just had a show at the Whitney, and she was sitting at the kitchen table, and she said, and you know, it was the best attended show outside of Andrew Wyeth. And I said, well, Miss O'Keefe, what do you think of Wyeth? And she said, well, I think he does what he does very well. Which was a nice way of saying nothing. She was another one who was, she had a sense of humor. And
your A-Tempera, Andrew Wyeth. Was that an influence, or did you?
I am influenced by him, and I hope that the influence has come by honestly enough. He's being there was two or three decades there, like in the 80s and 90s, where, you know, mention Andrew Wyeth to anyone who was serious about art, and it was like showing a cross to a werewolf. That's not true anymore. I mean, the National Gallery 2 years ago had that show of windows, and he's being reevaluated. And at his best, you know, he suffers when you see too much of him. But that's true of a lot of artists. When you see too much of an artist's work, you know, then it's... And I think that's a mistake that a lot of artists make in galleries, is that sometimes they try to show too much. That's just my opinion. But I think if a show were put together of 6 or 7 of his greatest landscapes and 4 or 5 of his best human images, you know, there's greatest paintings in Santa Fe of Carl with the hooks over the ceiling. Yeah, it belongs to a person in Santa Fe. Yeah, it's one of the great paintings of the 20th century, I think. And I don't know, maybe a few other things. If it was really, you know, boiled down, it would show that he's really an incomparable artist. So, yes, I hope if I am influenced by him, and I hope
why
that...
Why do you love tempera? That's more the question of, like, tell us about the medium of tempera.
Well, I do have a tendency to be messy, the tempera kind of forces you to clean your act up. But also, I like the it has a very readable surface, which I like, and I like the kind of velvety, dusty, matte finish. Even when I paint in oil, I use liquin or the the alkoids, which really dry to a kind of matte finish. I prefer that, and a lot of artists prefer shiny finish, which is fine. Hey, you know, we've got to do what you like. One's not any better than the other. But, you know, again, we're talking about the thing with the abstraction and realism. Look at Vermeer. At his very best, you can turn a Vermeer upside down, and it's very interesting. I mean, the best Vermeers, there's some Vermeers that are no good. I mean, they're worth millions and millions of dollars, but there's only, about 28 or 9 that are verified Vermeers. And really only about 14 or 15 of them are just, you know, like the lace maker or the really great ones. And he was human. He did some things. They have that thing in the Metropolitan of that woman standing by a globe with a snake on the floor. I don't know. I think it must have been some crazy commission. But it's not a great painting like the others that are, you know, that woman pouring the milk and... reading the letters that's in the Frick, and, you know, you turn them upside down, and the way he broke up space was exciting and cosmic. I do think that inner scale is very crucial, very, very crucial. How the shapes, whether you're an abstractionist or a realist, how the inner scale of a thing works is very crucial. And Vermeer at his best, again, is a great example of that. And Rothko is a great example of that. Although, unfortunately, you know, Rothko kind of ran out of gas, just like Pollock. That's what happens whenever abstraction is really based on a concept. And after you turn a concept every way, and you can't turn it any other ways. Like Pollock... tried to get figuration back into those drip paintings, and they were disasters. The Dallas Museum has a painting, it's a drip painting of his, but then he tried to put two profiles. It looked like a high school student did it. It's a disaster of a painting, and he knew it, and it's probably why he did what he did. And the same thing with Rothko. The last things of Rothko were totally gray, you know. He did everything he could with it. That's the thing. And that's the danger of concepts, is that... and that's the importance of following your inspiration, because the inspiration is going to have a freshness about it, I think. The spirit that the thing is done in is what's really important. And I've noticed that in my life, that when I've gone into the studio and thought, well, what can I do that will sell? It usually doesn't work. It's what do I need? What do I want? What's going to make me happy? And it ends up that someone else needs it, and it makes them feel happy, and they want it. So it's the spirit that the thing is done in that's the important thing.
There was a scene under a bridge that you did. It was quite big. It was like 70, maybe 74 high. It was a big vertical piece. And it was a underpass scene. It was a urban scene, not a landscape. It was a landscape, but it was an urban landscape of an underpass. And it was all of the features of what was under a bridge.
That was an idea I got in London. And that actually has a person in it, but you have to look kind of hard. I just like the way that the shape of the bridge enlivened the landscape that was beyond it. You know, they emphasized it, and
it was the framing.
Mm-hmm. Also, you know, sometimes this thing about influences, I loved a painting by Charles Birchfield that had a tunnel, and that helped inspire me to do that painting. But it doesn't look like the Birchfield at all. Don't you see? And I found also that when I have problems and troubles with doing something, I think, well, how would so-and-so in my mind, you know, solve this problem? And that's one reason why I have all these books. But it helps me solve the problem, but it doesn't necessarily look like Wayne Thiebaud or anybody else. It's just, you know, it's still been filtered through my mind. Your admiration and or respect or excitement about the other person's work can help you with your own. It's real important when you're experiencing, as you're an artist, like in a museum or gallery or something, to say to yourself, well, what is it I like about this, and what is it I don't like about this? Because that helps you find your own way.
That, I guess, crisis point in the process. Yeah. You've said that's really important.
Yes, it seems like every big painting, especially, well, just about everything I do, does have at least, sometimes it lasts for a long time. It has a period of crisis, I guess, a period, I call it my whatever made me think I could paint. Well, I'm serious, you know, it's like, oh, God, this is just, why did I even start this? But that's important because that is when the ego is giving up. And then there's some chance for some growth, at least possibility, because you can't grow with your ego. Your ego is a wild animal on your back, and you've got to get it off your back. And then there's the possibility of horizons widening before you.
Woody Gwynn, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. Thank you, Matthew Higginbotham and Denise Lynch, for your company and your great questions.
You've been listening to my pre-pandemic interview with artist and Galisteo resident Woody Gwynn. You can support Radio Free Galisteo by going to www.patreon.com/Radio Free Galisteo. For Radio Free Galisteo, I'm John Shannon.